Chapter 11. Meanwhile, what about socialism? It hardly needs pointing out that at this moment we are in a very serious mess, so serious that even the dullest-witted people find it difficult to remain unaware of it. We are living in a world in which nobody is free, in which hardly anybody is secure, in which it is almost impossible to be honest and to remain alive. For enormous blocks of the working class, the conditions of life are such as I have described in the opening chapters of this book, and there is no chance of those conditions showing any fundamental improvement. The very best the English working class can hope for is an occasional temporary decrease in unemployment when this or that industry is artificially stimulated by, for instance, rearmament. Even the middle classes, for the first time in their history, are feeling the pinch. They have not known actual hunger yet, but more and more of them find themselves floundering in a sort of deadly net of frustration in which it is harder and harder to persuade yourself that you are either happy, active, or useful. Even the lucky ones at the top, the real bourgeoisie, are haunted periodically by a consciousness of the miseries below, and still more by fears of the menacing future. And this is merely a preliminary stage, in a country still rich with the loot of 100 years. Presently there may be coming God knows what horrors, horrors of which, in this sheltered island, we have not even a traditional knowledge. And all the while everyone who uses his brain knows that socialism, as a world system and wholeheartedly applied, is a way out. It would at least ensure our getting enough to eat even if it deprived us of everything else. Indeed, from one point of view, socialism is such elementary common sense that I am sometimes amazed that it has not established itself already. The world is a raft sailing through space with, potentially, plenty of provisions for everybody. The idea that we must all cooperate and see to it that everyone does his fair share of the work and gets his fair share of the provisions seems so blatantly obvious that one would say that no one could possibly fail to accept it unless he had some corrupt motive for clinging to the present system. Yet the fact that we have got to face is that socialism is not establishing itself. Instead of going forward, the cause of socialism is visibly going back. At this moment, socialists almost everywhere are in retreat before the onslaught of fascism, and events are moving at terrible speed. As I write this, the Spanish fascist forces are bombarding Madrid, and it is quite likely that before the book is printed we shall have another fascist country to add to the list. Not to mention a fascist control of the Mediterranean, which may have the effect of delivering British foreign policy into the hands of Mussolini. I do not, however, want here to discuss the wider political issues. What I am concerned with is the fact that socialism is losing ground exactly where it ought to be gaining it. With so much in its favor, for every empty belly is an argument for socialism, the idea of socialism is less widely accepted than it was 10 years ago. The average thinking person nowadays is not merely not a socialist, he is actively hostile to socialism. This must be due chiefly to mistaken methods of propaganda. It means that socialism, in the form in which it is now presented to us, has about it something inherently distasteful, something that drives away the very people who ought to be flocking to its support. A few years ago this might have seemed unimportant. It seems only yesterday that socialists, especially orthodox Marxists, were telling me with superior smiles that socialism was going to arrive of its own accord by some mysterious process called historic necessity. Possibly that belief still lingers, but it has been shaken, to say the least of it. Hence the sudden attempts of communists in various countries to ally themselves with democratic forces which they have been sabotaging for years past. At a moment like this, it is desperately necessary to discover just why socialism has failed in its appeal. And it is no use writing off the current distaste for socialism as the product of stupidity or corrupt motives. If you want to remove that distaste, you have got to understand it, which means getting inside the mind of the ordinary objector to socialism, or at least regarding his viewpoint sympathetically. No case is really answered until it has had a fair hearing. Therefore, rather paradoxically, in order to defend socialism it is necessary to start by attacking it. In the last 3 chapters one tried to analyze the difficulties that are raised by our anachronistic class system. I shall have to touch on that subject again, because I believe that the present intensely stupid handling of the class issue may stampede quantities of potential socialists into fascism. In the chapter following this one, I want to discuss certain underlying assumptions that alienate sensitive minds from socialism. But in the present chapter 1, I'm merely dealing with the obvious, preliminary objections, the kind of thing that the person who is not a socialist, I don't mean the, where's the money to come from? Type, always starts by saying when you tax him on the subject. Some of these objections may appear frivolous or self-contradictory, but that is beside the point, I am merely discussing symptoms. Anything is relevant which helps to make clear why socialism is not accepted. And please notice that I am arguing for socialism, not against it. But for the moment I am advocatus diaboli. I am making out a case for the sort of person who is in sympathy with the fundamental aims of socialism, who has the brains to see that socialism would work, but who in practice always takes to flight when socialism is mentioned. Question a person of this type, and you will often get the semi-frivolous answer, I don't object to socialism, but I do object to socialists. Logically, it is a poor argument, but it carries weight with many people. As with the Christian religion, the worst advertisement for socialism is its adherents. The first thing that must strike any outside observer is that socialism in its developed form is a theory confined entirely to the middle class. The typical socialist is not, as tremulous old ladies imagine, a ferocious-looking working man with greasy overalls and a raucous voice. He is either a youthful snob Bolshevik who in 5 years' time will quite probably have made a wealthy marriage and been converted to Roman Catholicism. Or, still more typically, a prim little man with a white-collar job, usually a secret teetotaler and often with vegetarian leanings, with a history of nonconformity behind him, and, above all, with a social position which he has no intention of forfeiting. This last type is surprisingly common in socialist parties of every shade. It has perhaps been taken over en bloc from the old Liberal Party. In addition to this, there is the horrible, the really disquieting, prevalence of cranks wherever socialists are gathered together. One sometimes gets the impression that the mere words socialism and communism draw towards them with magnetic force every fruit juice drinker, nudist, sandal wearer, sex maniac, Quaker, nature cure, quack, pacifist and feminist in England. One day this summer I was riding through Letchworth when the bus stopped and two dreadful-looking old men got onto it. They were both about 60, both very short, pink and chubby, and both hatless. One of them was obscenely bald, the other had long grey hair bobbed in the Lloyd George style. They were dressed in pistachio-colored shirts and khaki shorts into which their huge bottoms were crammed so tightly that you could study every dimple. Their appearance created a mild stir of horror on top of the bus. The man next to me, a commercial traveler I should say, glanced at me, at them, and back again at me, and murmured, socialists, as who should say, Red Indians. He was probably right, the ILP were holding their summer school at Letchworth. But the point is that to him, as an ordinary man, a crank meant a socialist and a socialist meant a crank. Any socialist, he probably felt, could be counted on to have something eccentric about him. And some such notion seems to exist even among socialists themselves. For instance, I have here a prospectus from another summer school which states its terms per week and then asks me to say, whether my diet is ordinary or vegetarian. They take it for granted, you see, that it is necessary to ask this question. This kind of thing is by itself sufficient to alienate plenty of decent people. And their instinct is perfectly sound, for the food crank is by definition a person willing to cut himself off from human society in hopes of adding 5 years onto the life of his carcass, that is, a person out of touch with common humanity. To this you have got to add the ugly fact that most middle-class socialists, while theoretically pining for a classless society, cling like glue to their miserable fragments of social prestige. I remember my sensations of horror on first attending an ILP branch meeting in London. It might have been rather different in the north, where the bourgeoisie are less thickly scattered. Are these mingy little beasts, I thought, the champions of the working class? For every person there, male and female, bore the worst stigmata of sniffish middle-class superiority. If a real working man, a miner dirty from the pit, for instance, had suddenly walked into their midst, they would have been embarrassed, angry, and disgusted. Some, I should think, would have fled holding their noses. You can see the same tendency in socialist literature, which, even when it is not openly written de haute en bas, is always completely removed from the working class in idiom and manner of thought. The Coles, Webbs, Strachey's, etc. are not exactly proletarian writers. It is doubtful whether anything describable as proletarian literature now exists. Even The Daily Worker is written in standard South English, but a good music hall comedian comes nearer to producing it than any socialist writer I can think of. As for the technical jargon of the communists, it is as far removed from the common speech as the language of a mathematical textbook. I remember hearing a professional communist speaker address a working-class audience. His speech was the usual bookish stuff, full of long sentences and parentheses and notwithstanding and, be that as it may, besides the usual jargon of ideology and class consciousness and proletarian solidarity and all the rest of it. After him a Lancashire working man got up and spoke to the crowd in their own broad lingo. There was not much doubt which of the two was nearer to his audience, but I do not suppose for a moment that the Lancashire working man was an orthodox communist. For it must be remembered that a working man, so long as he remains a genuine working man, is seldom or never a socialist in the complete, logically consistent sense. Very likely he votes Labour, or even communist if he gets the chance, but his conception of socialism is quite different from that of the book-trained socialist higher up. To the ordinary working man, the sort you would meet in any pub on Saturday night, socialism does not mean much more man better wages and shorter hours and nobody bossing you about. To the more revolutionary type, the type who is a hunger marcher and is blacklisted by employers, the word is a sort of rallying cry against the forces of oppression, a vague threat of future violence. But, so far as my experience goes, no genuine working man grasps the deeper implications of socialism. Often, in my opinion, he is a truer socialist than the orthodox Marxist, because he does remember, what the other so often forgets, that socialism means justice and common decency. But what he does not grasp is that socialism cannot be narrowed down to mere economic justice and that a reform of that magnitude is bound to work immense changes in our civilization and his own way of life. His vision of the socialist future is a vision of present society with the worst abuses left out, and with interests centering round the same things as at present: family life, the pub, football, and local politics. As for the philosophic side of Marxism, the P.N. Thimble trick with those three mysterious entities, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, I have never met a working man who had the faintest interest in it. It is of course true that plenty of people of working-class origin are socialists of the theoretical bookish type. But they are never people who have remained working men, they don't work with their hands, that is. They belong either to the type I mentioned in the last chapter, the type who squirms into the middle class via the literary intelligentsia, or the type who becomes a labor MP or a high-up trade union official. This last type is one of the most desolating spectacles the world contains. He has been picked out to fight for his mates, and all it means to him is a soft job and the chance of bettering himself. Not merely while but by fighting the bourgeoisie he becomes a bourgeois himself. And meanwhile it is quite possible that he has remained an orthodox Marxist. But I have yet to meet a working miner, steelworker, cotton weaver, docker, navvy or whatnot who was ideologically sound. One of the analogies between communism and Roman Catholicism is that only the educated are completely orthodox. The most immediately striking thing about the English Roman Catholics, I don't mean the real Catholics, I mean the converts, Ronald Knox, Arnold Lunedinhoek genus, is their intense self-consciousness. Apparently they never think, certainly they never write, about anything but the fact that they are Roman Catholics. This single fact and the self-praise resulting from it form the entire stock-in-trade of the Catholic literary man. But the really interesting thing about these people is the way in which they have worked out the supposed implications of orthodoxy until the tiniest details of life are involved. Even the liquids you drink, apparently, can be orthodox or heretical. Hence the campaigns of Chesterton, Beachcomber, etc., against tea and in favor of beer. According to Chesterton, tea drinking is pagan, while beer drinking is Christian, and coffee is the Puritan's opium. It is unfortunate for this theory that Catholics abound in the temperance movement and the greatest tea boozers in the world are the Catholic Irish. But what I am interested in here is the attitude of mind that can make even food and drink an occasion for religious intolerance. A working-class Catholic would never be so absurdly consistent as that. He does not spend his time in brooding on the fact that he is a Roman Catholic, and he is not particularly conscious of being different from his non-Catholic neighbors. Tell an Irish dock laborer in the slums of Liverpool that his cup of tea is pagan, and he will call you a fool. And even in more serious matters, he does not always grasp the implications of his faith. In the Roman Catholic homes of Lancashire, you see the crucifix on the wall and the daily worker on the table. It is only the educated man, especially the literary man, who knows how to be a bigot. And, mutatis mutandis, it is the same with communism. The creed is never found in its pure form in a genuine proletarian. It may be said, however, that even if the theoretical book-trained socialist is not a working man himself, at least he is actuated by a love of the working class. He is endeavoring to shed his bourgeois status and fight on the side of the proletariat. That, obviously, must be his motive. But is it? Sometimes I look at a socialist, the intellectual, tract-writing type of socialist, with his pullover, his fuzzy hair, and his Marxian quotation, and wonder what the devil his motive really is. It is often difficult to believe that it is a love of anybody, especially of the working class, from whom he is of all people the furthest removed. The underlying motive of many socialists, I believe, is simply a hypertrophied sense of order. The present state of affairs offends them not because it causes misery, still less because it makes freedom impossible, but because it is untidy. What they desire, basically, is to reduce the world to something resembling a chessboard. Take the plays of a lifelong socialist like Shaw. How much understanding or even awareness of working-class life do they display? Shaw himself declares that you can only bring a working man on the stage as an object of compassion. In practice, he doesn't bring him on even as that, but merely as a sort of W.W. Jacobs figure of fun, the ready-made comic East Ender, like those in Major Barbara and Captain Brassbound's Conversion. At best, his attitude to the working class is the sniggering Punch attitude. In more serious moments, consider, for instance, the young man who symbolizes the dispossessed classes in Miss Alliance. He finds them merely contemptible and disgusting. Poverty and, what is more, the habits of mind created by poverty, are something to be abolished from above, by violence if necessary, perhaps even preferably by violence. Hence his worship of great men and appetite for dictatorships, fascist or communist. For to him, apparently, vide his remarks apropos of the Italo-Abyssinian War and the Stalin-Wells conversations, Stalin and Mussolini are almost equivalent persons. You get the same thing in a more mealy-mouthed form in Mrs. Sidney Webb's autobiography, which gives, unconsciously, a most revealing picture of the high-minded socialist slum visitor. The truth is that to many people, calling themselves socialists, revolution does not mean a movement of the masses with which they hope to associate themselves. It means a set of reforms which we, the clever ones, are going to impose upon them, the lower orders. On the other hand, it would be a mistake to regard the book-trained socialist as a bloodless creature entirely incapable of emotion. Though seldom giving much evidence of affection for the exploited, he is perfectly capable of displaying hatred, a sort of queer, theoretical, in vacuo hatred, against the exploiters. Hence the grand old socialist sport of denouncing the bourgeoisie. It is strange how easily almost any socialist writer can lash himself into frenzies of rage against the class to which, by birth or by adoption, he himself invariably belongs. Sometimes the hatred of bourgeois habits and ideology is so far-reaching that it extends even to bourgeois characters in books. According to Henri Barbusse, the characters in the novels of Proust, Gide, etc. are characters whom one would dearly love to have at the other side of a barricade. A barricade, you observe. Judging from Le Fou, I should have thought Barbusse's experience of barricades had left him with a distaste for them. But the imaginary bayoneting of bourgeois, who presumably don't hit back, is a bit different from the real article. The best example of bourgeois baiting literature that I have yet come across is Mirsky's Intelligentsia of Great Britain. This is a very interesting and ably written book, and it should be read by everyone who wants to understand the rise of fascism. Mirsky, formerly Prince Mirsky, was a white Russian émigré who came to England and was for some years a lecturer in Russian literature at London University. Later he was converted to communism, returned to Russia, and produced this book as a sort of show-up of the British intelligentsia from a Marxist standpoint. It is a viciously malignant book, with an unmistakable note of, "Now I'm out of your reach, I can say what I like about you," running all through it. And apart from a general distortion, it contains some quite definite and probably intentional misrepresentation, as, for instance, when Conrad is declared to be no less imperialist than Kipling, and D. H. Lawrence is described as writing bare-bodied pornography and as having succeeded in erasing all clues to his proletarian origin, as though Lawrence had been a pork butcher climbing into the House of Lords. This kind of thing is very disquieting when one remembers that it is addressed to a Russian audience who have no means of checking its accuracy. But what I am thinking of at the moment is the effect of such a book on the English public. Here you have a literary man of aristocratic extraction, a man who had probably never in his life spoken to a working man on anything approaching equal terms, uttering venomous screams of libel against his bourgeois colleagues. Why? So far as appearances go, from pure malignity. He is battling against the British intelligentsia, but what is he battling for? Within the book itself there is no indication. Hence the net effect of books like this is to give outsiders the impression that there is nothing in communism except hatred. And here once again you come upon that queer resemblance between communism and, convert, Roman Catholicism. If you want to find a book as evil-spirited as the Intelligentsia of Great Britain, the likeliest place to look is among the popular Roman Catholic apologists. You will find there the same venom and the same dishonesty, though, to do the Catholic justice, you will not usually find the same bad manners. Queer that Comrade Mirsky's spiritual brother should be father. The communist and the Catholic are not saying the same thing. In a sense they are even saying opposite things, and each would gladly boil the other in oil if circumstances permitted. But from the point of view of an outsider they are very much alike. The fact is that socialism, in the form in which it is now presented, appeals chiefly to unsatisfactory or even inhuman types. On the one hand you have the warm-hearted unthinking socialist, the typical working-class socialist, who only wants to abolish poverty and does not always grasp what this implies. On the other hand, you have the intellectual, book-trained socialist, who understands that it is necessary to throw our present civilization down the sink and is quite willing to do so. And this type is drawn, to begin with, entirely from the middle class, and from a rootless town-bred section of the middle class at that. Still more unfortunately, it includes, so much so that to an outsider it even appears to be composed of, the kind of people I have been discussing. The foaming denouncers of the bourgeoisie, and the more water-in-your-beer reformers of whom Shaw is the prototype, and the astute young social-literary climbers who are communists now, as they will be fascists 5 years hence. Because it is all the go, and all that dreary tribe of high-minded women and sandal-wearers and bearded fruit-juice drinkers who come flocking towards the smell of progress like bluebottles to a dead cat. The ordinary decent person, who is in sympathy with the essential aims of socialism, is given the impression that there is no room for his kind in any socialist party that means business. Worse, he is driven to the cynical conclusion that socialism is a kind of doom which is probably coming but must be staved off as long as possible. Of course, as I have suggested already, it is not strictly fair to judge a movement by its adherents. But the point is that people invariably do so, and that the popular conception of socialism is colored by the conception of a socialist as a dull or disagreeable person. Socialism is pictured as a state of affairs in which our more vocal socialists would feel thoroughly at home. This does great harm to the cause. The ordinary man may not flinch from a dictatorship of the proletariat, if you offer it tactfully. Offer him a dictatorship of the prigs, and he gets ready to fight. There is a widespread feeling that any civilization in which socialism was a reality would bear the same relation to our own as a brand new bottle of colonial Burgundy bears to a few spoonfuls of first-class Beaujolais. We live, admittedly, amid the wreck of a civilization, but it has been a great civilization in its day, and in patches it still flourishes almost undisturbed. It still has its bouquet, so to speak. Whereas the imagined socialist future, like the colonial Burgundy, tastes only of iron and water. Hence the fact, which is really a disastrous one, that artists of any consequence can never be persuaded into the socialist fold. This is particularly the case with the writer whose political opinions are more directly and obviously connected with his work than those of, say, a painter. If one faces facts, one must admit that nearly everything describable as socialist literature is dull, tasteless, and bad. Consider the situation in England at the present moment. A whole generation has grown up more or less in familiarity with the idea of socialism, and yet the high water mark, so to speak, of socialist literature is W.H. Auden, a sort of gutless Kipling, and the even feebler poets who are associated with him. Every writer of consequence and every book worth reading is on the other side. I am willing to believe that it is otherwise in Russia, about which I know nothing, however, for presumably in post-revolutionary Russia the mere violence of events would tend to throw up a vigorous literature of sorts. But it is certain that in Western Europe socialism has produced no literature worth having. A little while ago, when the issues were less clear, there were writers of some vitality who called themselves socialists, but they were using the word as a vague label. Thus, if Ibsen and Zola described themselves as socialists, it did not mean much more than that they were progressives, while in the case of Anatole France it meant merely that he was an anti-clerical. The real socialist writers, the propagandist writers, have always been dull, empty windbags: Shaw, Barbusse, Upton Sinclair, William Morris, Waldo Frank, etc., etc. I am not, of course, suggesting that socialism is to be condemned because literary gents don't like it. I am not even suggesting that it ought necessarily to produce literature on its own account, though I do think it a bad sign that it has produced no songs worth singing. I am merely pointing to the fact that writers of genuine talent are usually indifferent to socialism, and sometimes actively and mischievously hostile. And this is a disaster, not only for the writers themselves, but for the cause of socialism, which has great need of them. This, then, is the superficial aspect of the ordinary man's recoil from socialism. I know the whole dreary argument very thoroughly, because I know it from both sides. Everything that I say here I have both said to ardent socialists who were trying to convert me, and had said to me by bored non-socialists whom I was trying to convert. The whole thing amounts to a kind of malaise produced by dislike of individual socialists, especially of the cocksure Marx-quoting type. Is it childish to be influenced by that kind of thing? Is it silly? Is it even contemptible? It is all that, but the point is that it happens, and therefore it is important to keep it in mind.